51551. I can tell you there's a whiff in studio today. There's a whiff that you can feel, and it's not me for once. It's coming from the studio and from Mullingar, and the whiff is the whiff of election. They're all at it. The writs have been moved by elections, and we'll have the votes at the end of this month. So you can hear during the programme more impassioned pleas, especially from the politicians. They are today John Paul Phelan, Fine Gael TD for Carlow Kilkenny and Minister of State for Local Government and Electoral Reform. We also have Niall Collins of Fianna Fáil for Limerick and spokesperson for Foreign Affairs and Trade. Louise O'Reilly is a Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Fingal and spokesperson on health. And joining us from the Labour Party conference in Mullingar is Labour TD for Tipperary, party spokesperson on health and vice chair of the Public Accounts Committee. We're also joined by Áine O'Gorman, who's head of activism support at the Stop Climate Chaos Coalition. Now, can we first of all, quickly and briefly, on the back of Marion Finucane's interview with Moya Doherty, who's the chair of the RTE board, can we discuss the cost-cutting plan in RTE? We'll come to you in just a second and get your reaction, but put on your headphones, please, because we have Graham Macken, who's a SIPTU official. You're very welcome to the programme, Graham.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Moya Doherty was saying to Marion Finucane that the cost-cutting is necessary for the future survival and protection of jobs. Now, there's talk in the papers today from some unions that industrial action may be necessary. Can you confirm that, and in what context?
Yeah, I suppose if I could possibly just go slightly before that there on a number of comments that were made by the chair of the board. I think it's very, very important to note that the staff volunteered back in 2008 for a pay cut. Now, it was hard fought and hard to negotiate, but on the belief that it was going to go some of the way to turn around the fortunes and financial reality of the broadcaster. Now, the difficulty is there were a number of agreements put in place. There was one agreement that was titled the Guiding Principles Document. And this gave a huge amount of flexibility and a huge amount of possibilities in order to cut the cost within RTE, which the management quite simply, I think the best word to use is bottled and didn't implement it. But the difficulty has been...
They'd refute that, obviously. But can I ask you just fundamentally and briefly, there is talk of industrial action. Has that come from SIPTU, for example? And in what context would you trigger such action?
Yeah, what we have basically said quite clearly is in relation to, and we need to seek some clarification there, we'll be meeting again next week, but in relation to the comment made by the board that they were looking at tiered pay reductions. Now, we have been very, very clear that the majority of staff within RTE, despite what some people may think, are on the very, very low paid scale. They'd be a little bit above the national industrial wage. And what we have been very, very clear about is, should there be any attempt by RTE to implement pay cuts on this cohort of staff, we absolutely can't rule out taking the possible option of industrial action.
But okay, can I ask you, though,
a long way to go.
Can I ask you to respond to this excerpt from the Moya Doherty interview very briefly?
I think the unions are smart enough to know that this industry is changing dramatically, and I would welcome that they work with us to save jobs.
What about that? If you don't work with the RTE board, the implication is that jobs could go, more jobs could go.
And absolutely, and if I could deal with that very, very clearly, the members have not been found wanting, or the unions have not been found wanting. What I have to ask Moya Doherty is, why have the board continuously allowed the organisation to operate since 2015 on a deficit? I mean, basically, was the approach of the board, as far as we're concerned, was we'll spend the money we have in the bank, we'll run at a deficit, and then we'll go back and we'll seek extra funding.
Well, I can come to the minister on that, Minister John Paul Phelan. They have, in that time, been asking government for two things: extra funding and collect the funding that's due to RTE. That's what the board and the executives have been saying, but you haven't played ball with that. That's what they say.
Well, I don't agree with that. I think it's interesting that RTE were balancing the books in 2014, 2015, that sort of time, which was post the worst years of the recession. And in the last couple of years, things seem to have deteriorated again. I don't think it's at all unreasonable from the taxpayer's point of view that that the first port of call would be asking the management and RTE to look at how the money that they have is spent. And that's what we've seen this week in relation to the publication of the report.
So the line from government is, yes, extra funding when you reform. Is that it?
Yes.
And what kind of... OK, so that's quite clear. What type of reform are you looking for?
No, well, I mean, that's a matter... Like, the government can't get involved.
You can suggest... You can give us a broad idea. No. Because then it's a shot in the dark.
No, it is up to the management, and it would be completely inappropriate for any government to, particularly for the national broadcaster, to say, we want you to do X, Y and Z. But it is... Some of the measures that have been announced this week are reasonable ones, but there's also the ones from the regional perspective. I mean, I still think, and I don't know how to phrase it any better,
reasonable?
That there's an attitude in RTE, a kind of a Montrose attitude, that so much is run out of here. We see one of the proposals to close down the studio in Limerick. If we look across the world at other similar institutions to RTE, like the BBC, they took the decision years ago to move a lot of what they were doing out of London, and they do so much. Most of their radio is broadcast from Salford in the north of England.
Do we have a government spokesperson or minister telling us that we have too much focus on Dublin and RTE? I mean, pot calling the kettle black, I would say.
No, I wouldn't say so at all. I mean, I think the national broadcaster should look at what's worked in other jurisdictions and should implement possibly similar measures in this country. And I don't think it's at all unreasonable. Essentially,
are you in favour of the broadcasting charge?
Essentially, the charge is another tax, and we have to ensure that the taxpayer gets value for money. I am in favour of it, and the Taoiseach indicated this week that he's prepared to look at introducing it quicker. The 5-year time frame came from a group that was set up. I'm not sure, was it in Alex White's time or was it in Richard or Dennis Nocton's time?
So the broadcasting charge within 5 years, is that it? What's Fianna Fáil's position on the broadcasting charge?
Yeah, we've been very solid on this. My party leader said again in the last number of days that we would introduce this within a year of taking office if we're elected to government. We think it's critical that RTE is put on a sound financial footing. It's ran a deficit for 7 of the last 10 years. And in order to have RTE fit for purpose, to be able to fulfil its public service broadcasting remit, to deal with the challenges of fake news and disinformation, for all of those reasons, to attract a younger audience, to improve its digital content, to do all of that, there has to be reform, we recognise that, but there has to be a commitment from government. And I think that has been lacking, because the 5-year timeline which was indicated just simply isn't sustainable. And when you consider the amount of evasion that's out there in relation to the television licence, you know, it beggars belief that at this stage the government will not indicate solidly that it will act in a shorter time frame and move to a system of a household charge collected by the revenue commissioners. Revenue commissioners are experts.
Is it simply another tax, as John Paul
Feeney
calls it?
It's not. And I don't... I would disagree with government speakers over the last number of days who have been comparing this to the water charges. 85%...
What is the difference?
They're trying to say they wouldn't bring in a household charge for broadcasting because they don't want to face into a similar water charges type debacle. That is simply not comparable.
But is it fair to say we don't know where you stand on charges like this because of the way you flip-flopped on water charges?
No, we are saying the charge of €160 would stand, but every household would be levied it.
Okay.
The logical way to collect it is through the revenue
commission. That's quite clear. What's Sinn Féin's
position?
So,
first things first, I think the focus for the next while and the last couple of days is going to be on the massive high earners in RTE. And as Graeme has pointed out, the vast majority of people who are impacted by this do not earn those kind of salaries, the eye-wateringly high salaries. I think along with when we talk about reform, we're going to have to get into the space of accountability. So I sit on the Health Committee. The Director General of the Health Service Executive is accountable to the Oireachtas, is accountable to the Health Committee, is accountable to the Minister. And we can, as elected representatives, scrutinise that. That doesn't happen with RTE, and I think it should, because I think there is an important public service remit and I was talking about this last night to friends of mine, and you know, we absolutely need public service broadcasting
politicians say. Look at Pat Leahy's report yesterday.
That's not what politicians say, because
Leahy
I was talking to people who are not
yesterday.
Politicians last night, and they agreed with me.
Reporting, and this is not just the Irish Times, but you'll hear various reporters say, look, publicly, politicians like yourselves will say, oh, we need public service broadcasting and RT is very important. Privately, they say, we don't dislike that those lads out there.
No, that's not true. That's not true. Because in actual fact, we value public service broadcasting. I mean, and you can see the manner in which we reacted to recent Primetime Investigates programmes. We need those. We absolutely need those. But we need that accountability.
Why the inaction then over the last number of years?
We need
if the RT board and executives are telling you that public service broadcasting is threatened by not the non-collection of licence fees, if that is the truth, and if you believe them, why no action then?
They need to collect the licence fee. Everybody should be paying it. Absolutely. We need to fund public service broadcasting. But we also need to look at regional broadcasting and we need to look at balancing it. I don't believe that there is necessarily a massive Dublin 4 bias within RTE. But I think what we
John Paul Phelan thinks so.
I didn't say it was a Dublin 4 bias. But no, I didn't say that at all. I said, that they shouldn't be closing down. What I said was they shouldn't be looking at closing regional studios.
No, they shouldn't. They should be looking at developing regional programmes.
Yeah, so
let me go to the region, so to speak. I'll come to you in just a second because I know you want to get in on that, Niall Collins. But Alan Kelly, you're at the Labour Party conference in Mullingar. Where do you stand on the cost-cutting plan put forward by RTE?
The irony isn't lost on me, the fact that I'm here in a van in Mullingar. Public service broadcasting is 100% necessary. I'm here at the Labour Party conference, obviously, and it's important that events like this across all politics are covered. We believe that, obviously, this needs to be brought in. And the facts are that the hard decision that needs to be made by this government over the last 4 years hasn't been made. We need to have public service broadcasting in the real sense. The imagery of coming out with what RT came out with in a muddled way during the week, unprepared, despite the fact that they were meant to be announcing it a couple of days later. It was like something they had written up in the back of a packet of cigarettes, the way they went about their business. But the way in which they've announced, for instance, the closure of the Limerick studio, like, this is not the way to deal with things. The way in which they've communicated with their workers, like, they would be on television and radio giving out about organisations who would behave in this manner, and rightly so. And the fact that they are doing it, an organisation which we value and need to support, which is in the business of communications, is not able to communicate. That's what we learned this week.
In what sense?
Well, I mean, the way in which this was done was just ridiculous. I mean, and then
give me specifics. What do you mean?
On radio. I mean, the way in which it was announced, the way in which it was communicated to the staff, and to have actually, which I was driving my car at the time and I couldn't believe what I was hearing, to have the chief executive on the national broadcaster on drive time actually saying that they were going to hound and find out who leaked this. The irony of RTE's chief executive saying that they were going to chase down who was leaking the story about RTE on RTE is just, you know,
Adrian, can I come to Texters and I'll come back to you, Alan, I promise. Adrian in Blessington says, the problem is that the broadcaster is running a 1960s model to a dramatically changed media landscape. The BBC was and is in the same boat. Even when RTE was set up, it knew that a TV licence alone could not cover costs, hence why RTE uses advertising revenue as well as the licence. One option is to do what the BBC did with the TV centre in London, sell the site and relocate to a scaled-down version somewhere along the Naas Road, perhaps. Change needs to come from work practice in a changed RTE model, says Adrian. Áine O'Gorman, do you have an opinion on this? Because you are, well, I can say this openly, you're quite a bit younger than most people at the table here, even people in Mullingar. How do you see the broadcasting charge?
Particularly people in
Well, I suppose I actually agree that with Louise here that I spoke to a lot of friends last night and they do agree that public service broadcasting is really important. I suppose for under 30s, when we talk about a charge, like, we do pay for Netflix, we do, not a lot of the people I spoke to were engaging with RTE in the traditional sense. Not many people watch TV, they watch on the player or they engage with RTE journalists on Twitter, and they really value the service that brings. But I suppose we're engaging with a multiplicity of news sources.
Do you turn on the television set?
No. Nope.
To sound like my father?
No. Nope.
You don't at all?
No. Nope.
And when is the last time you watched TV?
I would say maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago when I went home to my parents' house for the weekend.
Yeah. And what about your friends? Is that common?
Yeah, like most people would, if they're watching something, they'd watch on the player. So for instance, last night I was out with some friends and they were saying, oh, Dublin Murders, fantastic, been watching on the player. Player crashes, but I will go and we want, you know, why aren't RT making Dairy Girls and more creative content like that? And then in the journalism...
They would say Dublin Murders, love, hate and so on, and they churn out, they would say good entertainment. But and they say they're working on the player. But it is interesting that people of under 30, you say, are no longer engaging in TV. So would you accept a broadcasting charge for mobile phones or iPads or so on?
I think it's a really difficult question. And no one I spoke to last night really had a real answer. But I suppose the key thing that came out was people saying, am I seeing people of my age, of diverse backgrounds reflected? Will I get value? Maybe I would pay it. I pay for my Netflix. Maybe I'd pay it if it was done in a just way and if I felt like I was getting value out of the service. And at the moment, I don't know if most young people are getting value out of it.
I'll read this text from Jaron Cork. At the risk of me never being able to enter the RT canteen again, RT TV is excellent on news and current affairs. They are utterly dreadful at everything else, says Jaron. Is this about values? What we value in terms of public service broadcasting, though?
Absolutely. And there's two points in that context. I want to agree with the Minister and Alan Kelly and others who have made the point in relation to the regions. The impact in Limerick was huge. And we have a fabulous studio in Limerick, Lyric FM operate out of there. And for the cost of a lease of a floor and a building, RTE are thinking of ripping out about 26 workers and families from the region, and that's simply not good enough.
Have you spoken with staff in Limerick?
I have, yeah, and they were very upset at the manner in which they heard about it. Some of them heard about it via text message from friends and third parties. It was exceptionally poorly handled.
But RTE would say they're not losing their jobs. Moya Doherty said to Marion, we have to, specifically in relation to Limerick, we've got to work above this, she says. Listeners want to know we can be nimble. And in relation to Limerick, that'll be worked out, she says.
Yeah, but like the point is made, and the Minister made a point in relation to BBC as a comparison. Look at BBC. We've got BBC Radio Scotland, BBC Radio Ulster.
They're far more funding, in fairness.
They deal with the regions. Yes, but that's why we have to put it on a sustainable funding.
Regional stations, just
to reinforce the point, Cormac, in relation to sustainable funding, why we have to close the gap from the avoidance or the evasion of people paying for proper content. Recently in the European elections, this passed a lot of people by. I saw a report in relation to alleged Russian interference in the European elections. I queried it in the Dáil with the tarnished Simon Coveney, and his answer was quite stark. And I just want to quote one line from it. And it was a report from the European Commission following the European elections, which were held just last May. It said, the report concluded that the evidence collected revealed a continued and sustained disinformation activity by Russian sources aimed at suppressing turnout and influence voter preferences. It went on to say the activity covered a broad range of topics ranging from challenging the unions, this is the European Union's democratic legitimacy, to exploit the divisive public debates and issues such as migration and sovereignty. So we have to have well-funded, credible public service broadcasting.
But it's
to counter
not, it's
this
not
type
well-funded,
of disinformation.
The RTE says. But can I put?
Let's look at where the funding was cut. Okay, so there was €80 million that was allocated by the Department of Communications. That was cut down to €40 million in terms of independent broadcasting. So that provides jobs. It provides people with an outlet. It means that we can produce indigenous content here in this state, which I think is extremely important. That was cut. So what we need to see is that funding restored. OK, so you wouldn't do it immediately, but you could do it at €10 million a year over the next 4 years to get it back to €80 million. There's absolute unanimity when you speak to people about the need for public service broadcasting. And we're not plamassing RTE or anybody else when we say it. We all value it. Nobody wants to see people getting their news or their information from disreputable sources. We absolutely accept that we have to fund it, but we've got to start with putting accountability back into the system. And that means being accountable to the Oireachtas and being accountable to...
I'll come to you in just a second. RTE could create a fabulous Netflix-type platform with its vast and mostly hidden archive. My kids don't watch TV anymore. Sink or swim, says that listener.
They'd have
listener.
To improve the player, Cormac.
Well, they're working on it, they say. John in Fitzroy says, Cormac, RTE in its current form is not a public service broadcaster. It should only have one TV station and one radio station. The rest should go. What is a public service station doing having pop music radio stations, a TV station showing US reruns of soaps and comedy's ridiculous, he says. Minister, you want to get in briefly?
Yeah, no, I just want to get on the disinformation point. I mean, over the last few days, I don't know, was it Wednesday and Thursday, but certainly Thursday in the Shannon Chamber, there were seven representatives of seven countries around the world, including Ireland, signed up to a new charter with regard to disinformation, particularly aimed at some of the points that Niall is making in terms of outside influences on elections. I mean, this is a huge issue, and the government here is very much engaged with the social media outlets in particular to try and ensure that we know where the information is coming from. I mean, the regulation that we can have on content, whether it's on social media or on the internet in general, it might be limited, but at least we should and need to know who's behind it, who's funding it, and where it's coming from. And that isn't the case at the moment, but progress is...
Okay, I'm going to take a 60-second break because I need to ask you and Louise O'Reilly and Alan Kelly and the Minister if you actually know the cost of the Children's Hospital as it stands, or if we ever will know. 51551.
Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1.
We're Gaid Faulge at Ash. We'll come to the costs of the Children's Hospital in just a second, but I'm joined on the line by Dr. Mary Aiken, who is a cyber psychologist, because we're going to talk about what is all over the papers today in light of the sentencing of Boy A and Boy B during the week in relation to the Anna Creagel case. And what is being discussed in the papers and in broadcast media for the last number of days is the access teens have to pornography. It seems that if you give an 11-year-old, a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old a smartphone, they have instant access to pornography and sometimes hardcore pornography with an element of violence. We will ask the politicians in just a second how to regulate this at a macro level. But can I ask you, first of all, and I'll come to Mary Aiken in just a moment, but Louise O'Reilly, as parents, this is a really difficult one, isn't it?
It is. And I'm not just a parent, I'm a grandparent as well. And I find it very tough when you consider this area, because it is not solely the responsibility of the schools, neither is it solely the responsibility of parents. It is a social issue. I think we need to get to a point where we are having a national conversation about consent, about what consent means. And I think it's only by that understanding and by open conversation, because certainly...
But in a way, isn't that later down the line? The question we have to answer here, I suppose, is what age should a parent... What age should the child be before a parent gives him or her a smartphone?
Every child is
the age, yeah. You see, that child should be of an age where they can responsibly handle owning
it's
a mobile phone.
Is 11 years old too young?
But it doesn't matter, because it depends on the child. And I think that's where you have to have an open conversation, because what you don't want are children going upstairs to their bedrooms or into locked rooms, viewing imagery that is not consistent with with a normal, healthy relationship.
This is interesting, because parents will wonder what your reaction is. So are you saying that in some instances, a child of 11 or 12 should or could have access to a mobile phone if he or she is mature enough, Minister?
Well, we have to look at a digital safety commissioner as well. I think that's important. I mean, Sinn Féin had moved legislation. It stuck a committee stage. We want to see that progressed. But the solution to this is not simply one line. It is a social issue, and it is something that we have to have a conversation about.
We'll come to regulation.
I think the other element of the conversation, as well as consent, is reality versus non-reality, and what children are consuming on their smartphone. Parents have responsibilities, and schools have responsibilities, but we've never... I mean, I suppose the age that we're living in now is so completely different. I was talking to my wife in the car. We don't have kids, but we were talking about this issue coming up, and she's a teacher, and she was saying that in one of her schools, second last school she was in a couple of years ago, a parent came in and asked her how to remove Facebook from their child's phone. And the parent's attitude was, you know, removing it removed the issue, which of course it doesn't at all. And but also the fact that the parent didn't know how to go about that themselves.
Should phones though be banned from schools altogether?
Most schools
have removed the issue.
Yeah,
from
most schools have either a ban or a it's in the locker kind of policy. Yeah. But there are other issues then regarding the other end of child safety, where say a child is in a one parent family and the parent is working and they need a communication mechanism with their parent after school for collection and things like this. Most schools, I think, do the put it keep it in the locker during school hours. But I mean, there are ways in which we can, and there are certain filters and different things that have to be done. But we do need, Louise is right, we've never really had a discussion. And I remember as a kid the Jamie Bulger story and the awfulness of that. And a lot of that was blamed on computer games, I think, at the time.
Video nasties, as they called them.
And there was a bit of a public discussion, for want of a better term, on it. And we've never really had that in relation to the impact that social media...
But we've had that discussion over the last number of days. And Alan Kelly in Mullingar, recent studies reported in today's papers say that a child's first exposure to porn is from the age of 11. Now, does that surprise you?
It actually doesn't, because of the, I suppose, the access level that's there now. I have young kids myself, you know, relating to your previous discussion, YouTube is their medium by which they look at things now, and as regards any form of access, they can do it on my phone, they can do it on a laptop, or they can do it on television. So access is so wide now. It is a conversation across politics now we need to deal with, because we've proposed the Digital Safety Commissioner. We also published an online harassment bill. So as a party, we're being progressive about this. But, you know, across politics, we need to just own this, take control of it, and deal with it as a society, because there are real issues emanating. We haven't, you know, dealt with it properly to date. It's a collective societal issue. There isn't one single piece of legislation or one simple solution to this. It's a combination of a whole range of things: education, legislation, parent responsibility, guardian responsibility. One wonders
why haven't more things been done? I mean, Peter Crawley's article in the Irish Times has a line today which says, if families or schools will not educate young people about sex, the internet is always ready. Can I come to Dr. Mary Aiken, who's a leading international expert in terms of cyber psychology and regulation? And I'll come to you, Niall, and Anya, just a second. But what should be done? What could be done quickly, Mary Aiken, to protect teens from online pornography, first of all?
Well, first of all, I'm a little shocked to hear people say that we're not talking about this. I mean, I've been talking about this for about a decade. Numerous, many, many articles, radio, television, commentaries on the subject of online harm. But first and foremost, online harm is not a party political matter. It's a humanitarian crisis. And it's a crisis for our children and young people. It's vital that we deal with this for the good of the country, for the good of our society and in our children. And it's bigger than politics in any one government. We need to act together urgently.
How, though?
And address what is effectively an epidemic of harm. It requires urgent, effective policy and legal intervention. I'm working closely with the UK government, who I'm hate to say in an Irish context, but are miles ahead in this area in terms of how they're addressing online harm.
So what are they doing there, Mary, that we're not doing here?
Well, there's a current white paper under consultation which has actually joined the dots when it comes to online harm. And it's made the connection between cyberbullying, you know, revenge pornography, online harassment, misinformation, disinformation, sextortion, coercion, self-harm, suicide sites, the whole range of harmful activity which need to be considered together, and then legislation needs to address this area. The UK are also actively considering the area of exposure to extreme content and online pornography. In Ireland, we are so far behind.
So you say, you have been saying this, and I heard you on with Ray Darcy a number of months ago, I think, for example. You've been saying this type of stuff for the last number of years. Do you think government is not listening, simply?
I think there's no political will to address these issues. I think that what we see is point scoring at the expense of children.
Can I ask the Minister to respond to that?
Yeah, well, there's been no point scoring either here today or anywhere else. I mean, can you quote to me an example
but
in the Dáil.
No,
her point was that there's been political points.
Where's the action?
There hasn't been. Yesterday, or Thursday, was action on the issue of disinformation in terms of hardcore content. I mean, what you said earlier on about an 11-year-old viewing their first pornography, I don't know what age I was, but chances are I was in primary school when somebody brought in a copy of Playboy magazine or something like that. The issue isn't necessarily that it's pornographic. It's the hardcore nature of it.
Hang on, put on your headphones. Are you saying that's entirely different, Mary?
Ridiculous. And this is the Stone Age level of this debate. This is why we need politicians who are advised by people who actually understand what it means to be exposed to extreme content in an age of technology. Playboy magazine and 14-year-old boys, Stone Age analogy. It makes me so angry to hear this sort of rhetoric from ministers when we need to be actively addressing a tsunami of harm that is confronting children. We have no proper age verification online, and it's not 11-year-olds. It's 6 and 7-year-olds.
No, I think she's completely missing the point that I was trying to
make. You're saying as young as 6?
Exposed to extreme content online, yes.
Come on, why don't we move on this then?
Well, there has been some attempts in the Minister Daly.
Attempts, she says. Attempt. Why don't we have an online harm bill in Ireland like they do in the UK? Why not?
Well, actually, it's in...
I mean, God almighty, teens' lives are at risk here.
Teens' lives are... Well, you might remember a couple of years ago, I can't remember what the website was. Was it ask.ie or whatever? .com, which was based outside of Ireland. Francis Gerald was the minister at the time. It took a lot of effort to get it down. It did have... Because it was based outside of the country. And it did lead to at least one loss of a life up in, I think it was in Leitrim, a child, and it was never, because of the nature, it didn't require an email address for people to register, and people couldn't be tracked who had been bullying this particular child. So it's not correct to say that nothing has happened, but
well,
I do
on,
think that
no,
that's
nothing
not
widespread.
Enough has happened.
But no, I completely age verification. No pressure on the multi. Maybe it's
I'm entitled.
Maybe it's the social media giants that are headquartered in a European context here. Maybe you're afraid to grapple with them. Is that
not
it?
At all. I mean, that's why they were in the Oireachtas the other day. I completely want to refute what Mary, the point.
I
acknowledge her expertise in the area. I wasn't saying that viewing Playboy magazine was the same as viewing online hardcore content. That I was making the exact opposite point, in fact, that there's a complete difference, and that, you know, saying that at what age a child might see pornography bears no resemblance to what age they might be watching the real hardcore stuff, and teaching that child that is not reality, that's neither a relationship nor a casual relationship.
We're not protecting that.
Well, that's why we want to see our Digital Safety Commissioner Bill move forward, and it is stuck in committee. And I think, you know, Mary makes a really important point. You know, we can't put our heads in the sand about this, and perhaps we have, right? But without a time machine, we're not going to be able to fix that. What we need to do is learn the lessons that are available to us now, and we need to act. And I don't think that there is a lack of political will. There may be a lack of knowledge on what it is that we can do, and maybe that requires a further conversation. Maybe we should be listening a bit better. But all I can say is, from Sinn Féin's part, we have put forward the notion of a Digital Safety Commissioner. That bill is stuck in committee. It shouldn't be. It shouldn't be stuck in committee. We need to be able to
move
it forward.
That is only one element.
We still need to work on all elements of this. It is not purely the responsibility of parents. It's not the responsibility of the schools. It is a collective responsibility that we have to own.
Parents are frightened. Listen to this. Parents are at their
I understand
within.
That. I held a seminar in Swords for parents, and they were terrified. We had Cyber Safety Ireland in, and the parents came in because they don't know. The same as people my age, people in their 40s, we're not digital natives. We need that knowledge, but we also need the political leadership to be able to tackle this. We need to be out in front,
Have you been invited to the Houses of Parliament, to any committee, to share your expertise?
I have testified to any and every committee. And a specific point of fact, this government tried to bring in a digital age of consent of 13. I was one who led the campaign to oppose government, And fair play to Sinn Féin, to Fianna Fáil and to Labour and the Independents. They supported me and we defeated government on this issue. So the point is that the evidence is there, hidden in plain sight. Justice Michael White, a High Court judge, said that he is very, very concerned about the number of cases of young children committing serious sexual offences as a result of exposure to pornography on smartphones. So we have senior people in a legal context, we have academic experts, we have the cases coming through, we have the parents are worried, we have everybody except politicians actively coming together to urgently address this matter. The clock is ticking.
And in light of what happened this week, in light of what happened this week, Mary Aiken, you are proposing, I believe, what you call Anna's Bill in reference to Anna Creagill. What is it?
Absolutely. I'm proposing a series of bills in terms of addressing online harm. My bill in the area of self-harm, cutting sites, self-starvation sites and suicide sites has just passed through the Irish Senate and it's on the way to the Dáil. It is urgent that we stop these sites. But why is it up to me as an independent academic in my spare time to drive through this legislation when we have politicians on salaries sitting around while this harm is being done? Families, Irish families, are experiencing the devastation resulting from online harm. Exposure to extreme pornographic content, self-harm, self-starvation, cyberbullying, harassment, sextortion, coercion, suicide and death. Irish families are experiencing the consequences of political inactivity on this matter.
Okay, well look, it's an epidemic that we need to wake up to a lot more and a lot more urgently, I think. Dr. Mary Aiken, thank you very much indeed for joining us. I'll give you some text before I move on. Laura says, Cormac, regarding children accessing porn, surely parents control the purse strings. Parents have more control than they realise. It's time for parents to supervise their children, she says. Paddy says, Cormac, the approach we take to discussing pornography with our children is to talk about what is real and what is contrived. We take the same approach when discussing advertising, social media, violence in films and so on. This helps to develop their crap detectors, he says. I'm going to take a very quick break. Before I do, I'll go to Mullingar, Alan Kelly, on the cost of the Children's Hospital, actually, because we were told by opposition TDs, based on what David Gunning told the PAC during the week, of which you're a member, that opposition TDs ran to the microphones and said, we don't know the cost of the Children's Hospital, nor will we ever, until it's finished. Is that the truth?
Yes.
Explain
a number
the
of months ago, I'll just explain this. A number of months ago, I said that this was going to go over 2 billion, and the Taoiseach, without naming me in the Dáil, said I was exaggerating. Well, I have a very simple proposition to put to the Taoiseach. Walk into the Dáil, or else do a media doorstep at some point, he does enough of them, and say that it won't. Because it will. I mean, the letter we received this week was quite extraordinary for the following. It actually put a political cover for this government for the duration of their lifetime, because it said effectively they will not know. There's so many extras, so many issues that they have no cost on yet, and they will not have a cost on until the hospital is built and up and running. So effectively they're saying we'll never know the full cost until it's actually built.
But Louise now, O'Reilly,
Mother
the
of God, how can that be? How is that allowed?
Jeez.
Pascal,
well,
Donovan,
hang on a second.
Call the doctors.
No, hang on a second, because Louise O'Reilly is also the health spokesperson for Sinn Féin. The Taoiseach said during the week in the Dáil that there is no change to the allocated budget from since that was mentioned in December 2018 for the Children's Hospital. What has changed is that the contractor has made extra claims.
Indeed, and they haven't agreed a base price with the contractor, and the government expect that we will swallow phrases like it's not actually an overspend. In fact, it was an underestimation. I mean, I laughed out loud. I think a lot of people did. But in truth, this would be hilarious if it wasn't so serious, and if it wasn't for the fact that it is going to have a knock-on consequence for other projects. Nobody appears to be in charge of this. No nobody appears to be able to curtail the costs. The Minister for Finance has effectively washed his hands of it, as has the Minister for Health. We know 1.73 billion is the cost and rising, and the contractor seems to be in the driving seat here, and the government seem to be running along behind them.
The government is supported by Fianna Fáil. Do you know what the cost is?
No, and I think what came out of the Public Accounts Committee meeting last week was very alarming, if it wasn't already exceptionally alarming. And the point has been made repeatedly, and I had experience of it myself in the last week. I met a contractor, and I'm not going to name the person or give the contract, but they came to me. They had tendered through the government e-tenders for a job in Limerick in providing services to government building services, and they have been appointed. They've been through a rigorous process, and they have now been told, yes, be on standby, but we can't give you a start date, we can't engage you, we can't allow you to break the ground or commence the contract because the money is not flowing.
Is there an upper limit where Fianna Fáil would say, no, we pull the plug on the government here?
Look, there's going to be an election in the next number of months anyway. We know that. The Children's Hospital...
Well, there hasn't been to date.
Wait till you hear this text, Minister. Alan Kelly will find this intriguing as well. We're in the process of verifying this, but I'll read it anyway. A text for Sean says, no final design before they try... they went on site is the reason for this. I work on the project. The cost will go over 2.5 billion and Leo signed up to this.
That was a two-stage procurement process.
Can I invite Minister John Paul Phelan of Fine Gael then to take up Alan Kelly's challenge? Can you say, I guarantee that this will not go over 2 billion?
If I was building a new house in the morning, I wouldn't know until it was finished. What the final costs would be.
But you would know how much you could afford, John Paul.
That's the most ridiculous comment.
Yeah, with that. You'd know how much you could afford.
You would have it. No, hang on.
You would know how much you could afford. If you were a multi-millionaire building a house,
can I make the point? The final cost is subject to the claims. Labour Party, Alan Kelly, around earlier this year, produced two claims that were going to drive up the cost substantially. The claims were firmly rebutted by the board and weren't paid.
That is true.
Fred Barry was brought in.
Promise me this. It won't go beyond 2.5 billion. Promise me that much.
Every builder in Kilkenny now is going to want to be building John Paul Phelan's going to be building with that attitude.
The PwC report, any
civil engineering project is dependent on the claims that are finalised after.
Okay, so
that was in the letter this week.
Let me throw this logic back at you. If the contractor comes up and says, look, actually it's going to cost 2.8.
Yeah, and then you refute the claims, like what happened with the two that Alan Kelly brought out of the hat earlier on this year and weren't paid. This is what happens when anyone contracts someone to construct something, particularly a massive civil engineer, does the project go ahead
or is the project stalled?
These claims go on...
Don't they have you they over
usually,
a barrel?
No, they
the
don't.
Point.
They usually go on way after the construction has finished.
You ploughed ahead without knowing the cost and the design, the final design, so they have you over a barrel here, don't they?
So there's effectively no upper limit. Is that what you're saying?
No, I didn't say
there's
that.
There's no upper limit. But is the upper limit
the budget figure remains 1.73 billion euros.
The question has to be asked, with all these subsequent claims coming in from BAM, the lead contractor, you know, How are these coming in and why are these coming in? Why weren't they flagged? And I think some of the language that was that you know we saw in the PwC report in relation to it, and I have some of them jotted down here: significant failures, lack of sufficiently comprehensive or robust planning, poor at all levels of governance structure, red flags were missed, contained material errors and did not adhere to the public spending code. So there has been just a litany. This will be a thesis and a case study for future project managers. It's out of control.
We'll see how it got to this stage. 51551, back in a second.
Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1.
You're welcome back to the programme. Can we talk, Áine O'Gorman, of Stop Climate Chaos Coalition about climate change? Once you saw Richard Bruton announce a new levy on one-off cups and an increased levy on plastic bags, did you finally sigh and say, oh, thank God, real action on climate change?
Yeah, unfortunately, no, we didn't. I suppose on the latte levy and the plastic bags, you know, these things are important. We need to be reducing our use of single-use plastics. Plastics do come from fossil fuels, but at the end of the day, what we're looking at is these big systemic changes. And what we're noticing is with this new climate action plan and with the things that are coming out, most of them are focused on individual actions and taxes and levies on people. And the big systemic changes that we're looking for just seem to be slower to come. For instance, yesterday we had the issue with the peat plants being closed.
ESB plants in the Midlands,
exactly.
Yeah. But that's action, isn't it?
It is action, but the issue is that a Just Transition Commissioner was only announced yesterday at the same day that the peat plants were closed. And that's not fair. I mean, they've known for years that we need to close them.
And what about the people? Do you have any sympathy for the people who've lost jobs there and their families?
Absolutely. We have huge sympathy. I mean, in 1998, there was, for the Kyoto Protocol, for our 2010 targets, there was a research commissioned by the government which said we would have to move away from peat. I mean, they've had 20 years to plan for this, and that yesterday they've introduced a Just Transition Commissioner position is just not fair on these workers. So I mean, that's one thing. And then on the other side, you have things like, you know, the Minister for Natural Resources, Sean Canney, at an oil and gas sponsored conference last week talking about drilling and the hope that there was going to be more drilling in Irish waters. And the head of the Petroleum Affairs Division actually talking about targeting the younger generation about the benefits of exploration.
Well, yeah, but a lot of people say you can't switch overnight. Now,
Alan
Kelly, there's a big focus on climate action at the Labour Party conference as well. But do you accept the premise put forward by some people that you can't switch to non-fossil based fuels overnight?
Yeah, obviously that's not possible. This is going to take time. But it really needs investment. You actually need to use funding to make that change happen over a considered period of time. I think the way in which, from a communications point of view, and the way in which the workers in the Midlands were dealt with this week wasn't the way to do things. I mean, Richard Bruton, between RTE, Bord na Mona and ESB, he's certainly having a good crack off the public service or public-funded organisations, public state bodies. But it is going to take time. But the real issue here is actual actions that are funded, capital investment by the government, backed up by legislation and policy. We've had an awful lot of talk about it. It's now really down to action. I'm a former minister for climate change. I brought in our climate change legislation when the Greens before me failed to do so. It's now about the implementation, but that's going to take serious investment. And unfortunately, the level that's going into it at the moment isn't going to create the change that is necessary over the intervening years.
Is there too much focus, Niall Collins of Fianna Fáil, on individuals and individual action as opposed to cutting down herd numbers, for example, going after the auto industry and so on?
I think this time next year, I'd want to be seeing on the news the latest publication of the Collins Dictionary with the word Just Transition being the newest entry into it. I think, like the workers in Bord na Mona and ESB, they're going to have to see a real and meaningful application of what a just transition is going to be for them. Retraining, upskilling, giving them new opportunities. And that now has been stepped up because of the news of...
Is 2020 too soon to close those plans, do you think?
Well, look, I mean, the preparation from the Just Commissioner has been tardy. I think we need to have a properly resourced Just Commissioner, but we need individual actions as well. Now, you know, this little bit of focus on the Latte levy, that's fine. Look, the plastic levy was a really good measure at the time when it was brought in and it had an effect. So you need a whole host of individual measures.
This Latte levy is a Montrose tax. Is that what you call it,
can I just make one point? It was a very, very interesting, interesting thing in Monaghan. They've got what's called reverse vending, where people actually put their plastic bottles into a machine. We've one of those machines in Ireland and they get a coupon.
It's that kind of creative thinking
that is something that Friends of Earth, who are a coalition member of Soft Climate Chaos, are asking for. And they're asking for, Richard Bruton last year said that he would do research into it, and there's still no, that research hasn't been published on the
Positive Returns.
You
have the final word on that one. Muíochas leat, Muíochas leat, Niall Collins, Minister John Paul Phelan, Louise O'Reilly and Alan Kelly in Mullingar. Until next Saturday at 1 o'clock. Bye-bye.
Saturday with Cormac O'Hara was produced by Mary O'Hagan. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon. Research was by A.B. Philbin-Bowman, and Pather Carney was on sound.